She doesn't get out that much by the looks of it. Welcome to Groovy Movies. My name is Lily Austin.
And my name's James Brailsford. Hello.
Hello. Welcome to our final episode of Series 2. Boo-hoo. Woo-hoo.
Can you believe it? Like, Series 2, the finale. This is it, guys. This is where all the plot threads come together and the ultimate plan is revealed.
Exactly. I'm imagining like a beautiful plait of all the different threads coming together neatly down the head of some fabulous it girl.
I like it. But not too neatly, because we need a few little tendrils just to lead you into Series 3. So, a few questions should be hanging in the audience's mind at the end of this podcast.
I like that. I feel like the superhero movies are really rubbing off on you.
They've infected my mind, goddammit. The cinematic universe of Groovy Movies. To our long-term listeners, I'm sure you know what the themes, in-jokes, and cameo appearances are.
Well, on that note, you had a public service announcement you wanted to make, James, right?
Thank you so much. Yes, this is a public service announcement for all those people planning on seeing Oppenheimer, and especially the people in London. Please, please, this is me begging you, if you're planning on seeing it, take the time and the effort to go see it at the BFI IMAX, because it's one of the only two places in the UK where you can see it from an IMAX film print. And if you haven't seen an IMAX film print, you're missing out on a cinema experience. It's unlike anything else. It's not like seeing it at your local IMAX nearby. It will be a different experience. So if you've got a plan and you live in London, please go see the BFI IMAX. And if you're like me and you're crazy, where I live in Manchester, and I'm still planning to get the train to go with your good self, Lily, yes. We're going to go and see Oppenheimer and Barbie in the same day.
That's right. We're going to be doing a Barbie v Oppenheimer special soon after the release of when's it coming out? Was it the 21st of July?
Yes, I think it's Thursday, the 21st of July. So if not the very day, which, I mean, hopefully, but otherwise, as soon as possible around that time.
Absolutely. You can just hear the passion pulsating from your microphone.
Please.
But wait,
for
people who don't know, who aren't in the know, what is Oppenheimer? Because I think Barbie is slightly self-explanatory.
Sorry, good point. Actually, Oppenheimer is a biopic about, God, what's his first name? Jesus Christ. Fred Oppenheimer. No, it's a... God, what's wrong with me?
Jimmy Oppenheimer.
Jimmy Oppenheimer. What's his first name? Oh, my Lord. Anyway, it's about...
Who is Oppenheimer?
He's a scientist who was responsible for the Manhattan Project, which was the project that developed the very first nuclear weapons.
So,
pivotal in world history. Yeah. So, it was an arms race between the Germans and the Americans, because we couldn't let the Germans get the bomb first in the Second World War. So he led the team, and he started off a kind of idealistic scientist trying to help the world, and then as he's working on the project, realized, no, this is actually probably a really, really bad thing, and so it tortured him. So it's his life. I think it follows 30, 40-year period of his life.
And who is the director?
Christopher Nolan.
I feel like you're skirting around the crucial part of this whole plug, is that it's Christopher Nolan's new movie, and that is why James is calling on all our listeners to watch this film as it was intended to be seen. The best way possible.
Thank you. That's exactly it. BFI IMAX, do yourself a favor. It might be a few quid more. It's worth a few quid. If you don't think so, I will personally refund you. Don't worry.
We're going to be inundated with DMs come the 21st of July.
Thank God. That's some engagement. We need that engagement.
All right. But before we get to that in July, we are finishing up.
You got me thinking too far ahead.
I know. Yeah, we're very organized, we're planning. But we're finishing up this series with a conversation, and another topical conversation. We're getting into the topical because in the New York Magazine this month was their yesteryear issue. For our non-American, non-magazine fans out there, the issue was all about It Girls, New York It Girls. And with that in mind, we decided to do an episode on how It Girls have manifested and evolved in cinema.
Yeah, this is, you know, when we do this podcast, I'm occasionally like, is there a reason I can somehow fit a theme in that gets me to be able to watch a film I've been meaning to watch for ages? Mm-hmm. So this is my mwahaha, admitting how I've manipulated the entire theme so that I could finally watch It by in 1927's Clara Bow starring feature film. It's something that about 10 years ago, I read an article. Every 10 years, they must do articles about It girls. And so,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Read an article 10 years ago, I just assumed an It girl was like a society woman, you know, comes from money and parties around London town.
Yeah,
because
same.
Of my memory of that. Yeah, and so then reading this article that made you realize, okay, It girl's been around for a lot longer, and it started off essentially being popularized in an article, you know, so... And then reading that it was essentially a feature film that popularized the term It Girl, I had no idea. So I was like, I would love to watch that film.
Yeah, same. I had no idea. So actually the whole concept of the It Girl has its history in cinema, specifically in this film that made Clara Bow a star.
Yeah, it made her such a star that she was referred to as the It Girl because she was in the film called It, which that's where the It Girl, I guess, phrase comes from. Is like when Clara Bow was this, she made a huge star because of this film, and so she was so huge that she could just be referred to as the It Girl.
Yeah, so let's, should we just get into it? Let's talk about It. So this movie was made in 1927, directed by Clarence G. Badger and Joseph von Sternberg. But it's based...
I would just... Yeah,
go for it, go.
This Joseph von Sternberg is like a big director, so I was trying to find any information about what his involvement in the film was, and I can't find anything. So maybe he was brought in for reshoots. I reckon it's mostly a Badger shoot.
Interesting.
I wonder what...
Yeah, he wasn't... Okay, maybe this is just like some kind of fake news on the internet, because I swear in the credits on the film, it just said Clarence G. Badger. But then when I was doing my research... Joseph von Sternberg's name just kept coming up. So I was like, I guess I missed that. Weird.
Yeah, no, I reckon he was probably drafted in perhaps off the record to help out, but I can't find any more details. So it's a funny thing. Like, has somebody just added this to like somebody's Wikipedia stub and it's suddenly blown up? Because I would like to read more about what his involvement was, because he's a big name director. To have been involved in It. But anyway.
That's weird. All right, yeah, okay. If anyone knows, please drop us an email.
To let us know.
But as you said, it is a story based on a short story by Eleanor Glynn, originally serialized in Cosmo. And it basically is about this notion of it, which actually is kind of different from the definition that the term kind of evolved to mean.
We think of it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you know, I think of It Girls, like I said, as coming from money, and they go out partying and everyone wants to hang out with them because they're glamorous and they're famous. And then It, as proposed by Eleanor Glynn, is something a bit more nebulous. It's essentially like sex appeal.
Yeah.
I think it could be very roughly defined as sex appeal.
Yeah, for sure. So Glynn, in her book, it says, she defines it as, a strange magnetism which attracts both sexes. He or she must be entirely unselfconscious and full of confidence, indifferent to the effect he or she is producing, uninfluenced by others. There must be physical attraction, but beauty is unnecessary. Conceit or self-consciousness destroys it immediately. So in some ways, it's kind of...
So if you think you've got it, you haven't got it.
Yeah, if you think you've got it, which is kind of, I think It Girls... The It Girls that we later think of, they do all, I think, share this kind of laissez-faire, unselfconscious kind
indifference.
Of... Indifference. Yeah. Just natural chic coolness. But definitely Glynn's definition hinges on, like you said, like sexual attractiveness. This is about basically being sexy, everyone finding you sexy in an unselfconscious way. And that's definitely...
Not a big ask.
And it's interesting because... As the New York Magazine article, the main article in the issue discusses, that kind of goes away as the term evolves over time. And it also changes from England's definition. This is something men or women can have. And actually, the original short story is about a man who's got it and a woman going after
him. That was interesting. Again, I love doing the research and realizing that the book it's based on, the central character who has it, is a man.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, right, because... it's always it girls, you know, it's never really it men.
Yeah, no. It's completely gendered and about women. You don't really, it's not a term for guys, is it? So yeah, it's interesting that that's how it began.
Yeah. And again, watching the film, because I didn't really know much about it at all, was that the it girl that we think of is nothing like the it girl portrayed by Clara Bow in this film. She portrays a shop girl. She lives in like a slum tenement, you would call it. You know, she's not from any privilege, but she's the character who has it in the film. And it's...
Yeah.
And watching it, it's more that she has like spark and personality. She's like a little quirky and she's upbeat. You know, this seems to be the kind of it. And she's got like a flirtatious, you know, there's a life about her. And I suspect this is the it quality that we're talking about in the film.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think an it girl is so tied up with class and culture. Like you said, it's often associated with society, women from privilege who don't have to work, right? And yet in its earliest iteration, class is so tied up with it, but almost in the opposite way because, as you said, Clara Bow plays a shop girl. She's lower class and she's lusting after the guy who owns the shop the department store that she works at. And he's in a different class to her. And a lot of the film is actually about her being completely unashamed of her background but still going after him and then also kind of encouraging him to step into her world, right? There's a scene where she takes him to Coney Island and they go on the fun fair and everything, and he's clearly
so cute.
Yeah, it's very cute, and he's clearly never done that before. And her like cutting her dress so that she's got something appropriate to go to the Ritz. There's just this like, it's like she is totally unselfconscious, so in that sense fits with the definition. But then, yeah, so much of it is about her transcending class divides. And then in the final scene, she pretends to be someone upper class in order to get on this boat. And there's this like narrative kind of underneath the main love story about these divisions and about basically having it transcending those sorts of divides, which I think is kind of interesting as the term kind of evolves.
As it's progressed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like the opposite happened. So it was, like you say, it was a way of saying, well, it transcends class. And then suddenly we've got these Tara Palmer Tomkinson type characters who are total class and they are it. And you can't have it if you come from perhaps lesser background. I mean, but the New York It Girls are interesting from reading this article. Oh my God, I went on so many different rabbit holes with this New York It Girls article. I kept going, oh, this is interesting. It's like, God, James, come on, focus. But, you know, there were like two branches of the New York It Girls, and you had like the society It Girls, but then you had the partying It Girls, you know. So you did
the
have
the downtown
like this
It Girls. Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's so that not, I don't think it's the, even though I think we both think of, because we were both discussing before how, for both of us, Tara Palmer Tomkinson was like the first, she was the first it girl that really entered my consciousness. She was
same.
She was
such, because I think she had the article in the Sunday Times, and it was called The It Girl, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, really?
That's what it was called.
Yeah. It definitely is often tied up with kind of upper class, I guess, like, well, but even as that article kind of explores, goes through the history, it comes clear that these divides continuously kind of come into play, because like even like we're going to talk about Mahogany, like that film is about someone who is like from like a less privileged background trying to like make it and move into this more like glamorous world. And like you think of like Kate Moss, you know, she was a model who definitely became an it girl, probably the it girl of the 90s, and she also was from like a less privileged background, you know. She didn't come from a, so it's, there are always people like, you don't, it's definitely not a strictly closed thing, but then at the same time, there's such an emphasis on that, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. One thing that I just, watching the film, just to go off semi-topic here, but have you, do you watch many silent movies, or was this first silent movie you've seen, or?
No, yeah, let's get into that, because actually did we even discuss that this is a silent movie? This is my first longer silent movie, I think. I watched a few at uni, but...
But like short to half hour, like a lot of Chaplin and...
Yeah, exactly. Like 30 minutes. I've seen Chaplin and go on. What are your thoughts?
I watch some silent movies. I wouldn't say, you know, I don't watch anywhere near as many as I do talkies, but I just...
Because you're not 95. Every time,
yeah, I guess I don't know if I've been like... But they are like, they are a rich seam to go back to. I know that, for example, Christopher Nolan went back to silent movies to inspire his Dark Knight trilogy, because there's something about the purity of the storytelling, the fact that it's got to be entirely visual, that you say.
Yeah.
It's almost like going back to the classics in a way. Yes, the storytelling's very simplistic, and you couldn't make a film like this now. But I always enjoy going back to a silent movie and just like just watching this. Everything's on such a massive scale. Even the slum house that she lives in is ginormous. You know, just it gives the story, even though it's purporting to be set in the real world, this like cinematic scale and size. You know, which I don't know. I was really enjoying going back and watching a silent movie.
Yeah, I did too. The thing I enjoyed most about it probably was, even though you're right, the storytelling is quite simplistic, and with the how expressive they need to be, because then there isn't dialogue, does give it a theatrical quality that is lost.
We're not used to as much.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of goes from cinema over time. But I was actually struck by how human they... That sounds silly, right? But you think of like, you kind of... It can feel like people from 100 years ago, nearly, my God, are of another world and slightly different to us. But actually, Clara Bow in particular, like, I get why she became this it girl, because she is so unselfconscious and so kind of playful and very knows who she is. She's a very determined person. So all makes her very, very human and very, very relatable, which is kind of such a like thrilling thing to see in a film that was made 100 years ago, that they're just like us.
I agree. Yeah, no, exactly. I thought she's got this spark. You know, I was also watching this thinking, I think this is almost like the template to a degree of the romantic comedy female character. She's like this sparky.
Yeah, so screwball.
She's the kind of quirky, interesting character, and the guys in this, I tell you what, they definitely do not have it.
Yeah.
She has it, but all the guys, like, and if I was, here's the thing, if I was Clara Bow, surely I'd be looking to go after someone who had it, and he doesn't.
I know, but she doesn't get out that much by the looks of it, so there aren't that many men to choose from. Between what's his name and what's his name? Between the male lead and his sidekick, God, I didn't even bother to like write down their names. I'm just like, not even bothered.
I mean, I don't think it's a big deal. It's like the main lead and the kind of wacky sidekick. But it just felt like this is a very kind of setting the template for how you kind of have these female romantic leads. I felt
totally that aspect of it feels to me very less it, like. It's, I think in film, even though clearly, as we've said, this has been part of, this film is what gave us the term it, basically. It popularized this term and has kept it kind of going. I think her character is so un-it in that I think there is something about the kind of unknowableness and mystery of an it girl. I think a lot of the it girls that came up were kind of interesting because you didn't quite understand them and they didn't give too much of themselves, whereas Clara Bow is so arrestingly herself and human and relatable is like a really crap word for it, but just like endearing and vulnerable.
She doesn't seem to have that mystery.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, right, because that film, it was like a huge hit, huge box office success, and as we said, she became known as the it girl. This film made her a star, but in Hollywood, she was completely ostracized and an outsider. The other actresses didn't like her. They thought of her as pretty low class. Because, I mean, she wasn't.
Yeah.
That she came from a really, really difficult background. And I think all of that kind of that vulnerability in herself, her honesty about who she is so brilliant on camera. But obviously, it was just considered like not very chic, you know? And so
yeah,
she really,
she wasn't one of the cool kids.
Exactly.
She definitely wasn't an it girl, basically, even though that's what the entire film is. She was, yeah, you're right. She was very kind of true to her roots, very just energetic and personable. So there was no mystery. There was no airs, which was what made her popular. But I imagine in the insular world of Hollywood, she was just a bit common.
Well, yeah, I think that was it. There was a lot of classism that she was up against. And so, yeah, there's some irony to that, right? That she was known as the it girl, but actually what made her the it girl was having the qualities that are so not it.
The opposite of being an it girl. That's why I loved watching it. I was like, gosh, this isn't at all what I imagine an it girl film would be like. But one thing I just wanted to bring up with you, Lily, just which I mean, there was lots of pleasure in this film, lots of joy. One of them being, though, the cameo by Eleanor Glynn, yes. the author of the... What did you make of that? Talk us through, Lily.
I mean, this is absolutely mad. So as we said, this whole story is based on a short story by Eleanor Glynn. And she not only gets a writing credit, I think she's listed as the screenwriter.
Yeah.
Even though she didn't
actually. She adapted it.
No, she didn't adapt it. That is.
Oh, right. It was part of the deal.
That was part of the deal that she would be credited. But actually, it was like three men. I think I did write it down somewhere. But she wasn't the person who actually wrote it. But she was given this credit. And then also, as you said, she cameoed in a scene where that, I mean, this is an amazing early example of self-branding and self-promotion, because the opening scene, one of the characters is reading the Cosmopolitan article, so you get a full, you fully see on screen, like, and again,
product placement.
Yeah, exactly, the product placement of this story. And then she bloody appears in like a scene later at the Ritz and there's literally asks, what is it? And she extols what she defines it being. Again, it's like, we really got it. We got it, girl.
But come on. He's like, this is serious, legit. We've got the woman herself. Come on. Please tell us, what is it?
Yeah, and well, she said, if that were me and I'd written this article that was taking New York by storm and someone came up to me and goes, tell me what it is. I'd be like, honey, read my article. I'd be so insulted.
And I tell you what, quite useful for celebrity cameos by non-actors in the silent movie era. You don't really need to worry about fluffing your lines or not being very good. We just put the title card up and there you go.
That's so true. So true.
But I didn't know that was going to happen. I was like, oh, this is brilliant. This is how you made movies back in the day.
I loved it, because we talk about stuff being meta as if that is something very contemporary, but clearly they've always been doing that, the self-referential, the kind of out of world, inner world. So funny.
I could definitely tell the film was written by men. I mean, it's a silent movie era film. Storytelling was much simpler. I didn't expect to go to it to see any deep revelations about the human condition, but you know, for a film that's meant to be about it, doesn't really explore it much at all. You know, part of me was thinking, the cynic in me was like, was this just a film script they had on the shelf, like a rom-com about shop worker tries to get the rich boss, and then this article came along, like, oh, you know what we'll do? But I do think it was originally written, but you know, nowadays, if you were making it, I think there'd be more of an exploration of what is it? What does it mean to have it? You know, here it's just like, here's a quirky woman, she's gonna get her guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're totally right. Yeah, it is. It's just a rom-com with a really sort of an added-on conceit of this concept of it. You're right. After that initial reading of the article, like, it never really comes into it again until the end, when he's like, we all have it. We're a couple of its without it, or itless its, or whatever. But the thing
is, yeah, itless its.
But it's such an unquantifiable entity, right? The notion of having it. I mean, it's kind of fascinating, because it's just this thing that, I mean, as it evolved, right, it's just basically tabloids choosing women who go to parties and who are attractive. I mean, the funny thing is, right, is that the original it is so hinged on being sexually attractive, when actually the it girls weren't they're not really sexy girls. Like, being an it girl is never sexy in like an obvious way, right? Like, they you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm saying yeah, sure. I'm trying to think. I mean, I mean, if this counts for anything, which I'm not saying it does, but I can't think of any it girl from like, I find that it girl very attractive. It's more the lifestyle that you imagine that they leave, this kind of, they know everybody, everyone wants to at their parties. That's the attractor factor, isn't it? Just that they are the person who's got the in to all the cool shit that's happening.
Yeah, exactly. And in that article, they talk about how it wasn't men who were choosing, straight men weren't the ones choosing the it girls. It was women and gay men who were writing about these, these like women, like at the parties and stuff. So it's almost like, yeah, it's they're choosing people. Perhaps, I think it's almost like if you're too obviously appealing to straight guys, too sexy, then that's not, there isn't enough, like it's a bit too obvious perhaps. I don't know. It's such a, it's funny because also there was in that article, they use that as a proof almost that this isn't actually a sexist term. It's just a gendered term. Which.
Gotcha.
I don't know.
What do you think of this matter?
Well, see, yeah, I'm just like, let's talk about sexism and feminism and all this stuff again, my favorite topic. But I was like, I don't think that's quite right because just because you're like, sexism isn't just about like objectifying and sexualization. It is about making women a second class citizens kind of thing. And I think almost by like the very fact that it girls, a true it girl was one that didn't apparently have a job and just went to parties. And it just has this thing that's, by the way, very temporary. And that's it. And that's what they have to be stylish, mysterious. Yeah. Ideally, don't really stay too much and just go to parties and people want to be around them. And that is like the sort of, it's the most glamorous, but almost, the most like sort of like least aspirational. And also it's nothing anyone can, it's like, there's no work to that. It's just, it's like the bar is so low.
But if you happen to open a copy of the Metro and you found a splash and it was like, knew it girl, Lily Austin, would you be like offended or be like, oh, I'll take it, fuck it?
Well, I mean, I'm very much past the it girl prime being 31. So, I mean, a lot of these it girls, they did talk about how it harmed their career. Like, I mean, we can go on to it. Like, we thought about perhaps talking about Kids, the film starring Chloe Sevigny, because that film came out just at a point where she was becoming an it girl.
She kind of was the it girl, and she was so cool. She was kind of doing movies, but she didn't want to be an actor. That it kind of felt like that.
Yeah, well, I think she'd just moved to New York when she was asked to be in this movie. So she was kind of just on the upward trajectory, but she said no one really knew who I was. Like, I wasn't on Page Six at that point. That film kind of, I mean, they had the like foresight to like cast her because like crossing that way. But she talked about after that being referred to as an it girl, and that definitely harmed her in Hollywood. Right.
The credibility.
Yeah, because she said, you know, that's so synonymous with being kind of temporary and a momentary thing, you know. So Hollywood didn't want to touch that. And I think that's right? Like, it's funny that I don't think it girls are seen as like the most... Like, it is like the trashiest level of trashiest isn't quite the right word, but it's a very unrespected sector of the celebrity world. Okay, literally, celebrity on the whole is like weirdly like reviled and like dismissed at the same time. But go on.
So are you making the case that this is not a gendered term, this is a sexist term? Is that what we're saying?
I'm saying it's both. It's definitely gendered because it's definitely just for women.
There's no male equivalent.
But I think celebrating women for their lack of talent is essentially what it is. For just their God-given virtues and nothing that they're really...
I see.
Because also the interesting thing, right, with Chloe at 70 is, you know, she was... a very talented actor. Like, we decided not to talk about Kids because we both hate that movie. I hate that movie, but I think she is a very good actor.
I don't think I hate it. I'm also not somebody who's like, we must watch Kids. I'm not a huge, I'm flowing in the wind with Kids.
Okay,
I guess,
sorry. You know. Oh, it really bums me out, that movie. It's just like, look at all these teenagers being like, parents should be so worried because they're all getting AIDS.
They're doing
and
like
having
everything.
Sex. It's just like
the first time they have sex, they get AIDS.
Yeah, it's just like such like fear mongering, and all these kids are just such, all the boys are such terrible human beings. I was like, what is the point in this movie? It just makes me feel bad. Anyway, we're getting way off piece.
But don't worry, we didn't watch Kids. Instead, we went with a Diana Ross vehicle, Mahogany, from 1975, film that I'd never even heard of.
Oh, gosh. I've watched it a couple of times.
Oh, my God.
I did. I had thought about it before our, like, bad movies, you know, bad cult movies, but...
Because, God...
I'm glad we didn't, actually. It's perfect for here.
Perfect. Oh, so have you seen it a couple of times before even watching it for this, do you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, right. So you've... Oh, like,
not for a while. I'd sort of forgotten quite how... But it's like... It is considered like a camp classic. It is so extra.
It's so camp. And I was watching this, and very early on, I got the vibes of... I just thought, this is... not a good film, but I need to know about who directed this, because it really feels like they haven't directed a film possibly ever.
Yeah.
And so I looked up who it was, and immediately it was like, oh, it's Berry Gordy. Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown Records or Motown Productions, mm-hmm. Who were producing the film, and he had a disagreement with the director. They'd hired Tony Richardson, a Yorkshire director, no less.
And also the wife of Diana. The wife of Vanessa Redgrave, father of Natasha and Jolie. That's actually how I know him. I've not seen any of his films, I realised, when I looked up his back catalogue.
Yeah, I've not seen any of his films. They're all a bit too kitchen sink drama for my liking. But,
right, but that's it. Like, serious British acting calibre there. I'm not acting, like, filmmaking calibre there.
Right. And then I couldn't find any of the reasons why he got fired, but Berry Gordy fired him. And then he was like, right. Oh, brilliant. Tell me. Please tell me.
I think this might be apocryphal, but apparently they were filming in Chicago on the street, and someone shouted, like an onlooker shouted that, like, they don't know how to speak correctly. Like, this is clearly being directed by a white person because this is not how we speak, kind of thing. And and so Berry Gordy was like, no, like, that can't work. It needs to feel authentic. I'm just going to direct it myself. Mm. But that was like the story that I think his people put out there.
The important thing to take away from this is on IMDb, the sole credit for directing that Berry Gordy has is Mahogany. This was his first, his last feature film directing. So it's his debut and his swan song in one.
And this is a film that, again, was a huge, huge hit. Let's not forget, people went to see it, but the critics panned it, and Diana Ross wishes this film would go away. She refuses to speak about it. And when she got wind that the DVD was coming out of it, you know, many years later, she tried to stop it.
Oh, wow. Because I know that her and Berry Gordy had a relationship and they have a child together. So I assume
really?
She must have been... Yeah. Just from when I was doing a bit of research. So,
well, you can't...
Maybe they just don't talk about it in the house.
Well,
you know?
Yeah. Because the thing is, it is... Yeah, it's a very... Well, what did you make of the film?
I mean, my impressions of it were just... None of it seems to have any basis in reality. It's very unstructured. Like, basically, you could see that there's somebody who thought that film, being a director, just meant shouting action and cut, because the characters don't really make any sense. The interpersonal relationships don't make any sense. We kind of go from secret, like, I don't understand. Wait, so our main character, who becomes known as Mahogany, which is a model name, Diana Ross, she starts off in the theater world, then she moves to Chicago, and then, like, just...
No,
the sequence of events, I'm not really...
What do you mean? She doesn't start off in the theatre.
The start of the film is her doing her, like, there's a theatre show on. And she
that's her fashion show at the end. That's a...
No, but that's at the start of the film.
Yeah. That's
the version.
So that's that first opening scene is of what the film ends with, which is, or like comes very near the end. Do you remember she, like, when her designs are... being shown, that very first scene is a flash forward to what's to come.
Oh, is that, that
that's her at the peak of her powers, and then it's showing
her
climb
to that. I was so confused. Oh, right.
But I've seen it three times.
Right, this is a bit like me watching a Christopher Nolan film and saying, oh yeah, when you ask me why are they doing that thing, why are they changing a body bag in Dark Knight Rises, and I can go, oh, it's because of this and this. Right, got you, thank you, Lily.
Because it's very of its time, because basically this is a film about Diana Ross plays a aspiring fashion designer who is then discovered by a photographer, the evil Anthony Perkins. Why is he all, poor man, has he ever not played a baddie? Well, of Psycho fame.
I mean, talk about getting typecast in Psycho. You know, every other film. Well, we'll get the Psycho guy in.
But he does do it so well, to be fair to him. He's actually, I think he's more effective. Well, it made me think, like, he does so many different shades of evil, because actually Psycho is a very, obviously, insecure, unhinged. I mean, this guy's unhinged, but in a much more predatory, controlled
He's very
manner.
Confident.
Yeah.
And he's very entertaining. Like, I almost admit, every time he popped up, as much as he's ludicrous, he is very entertaining. You know, he's clearly trying to do the best to make an interesting character with what he's got.
Yeah, I think actually they all do. Like, I think Diana Ross, I don't think she is the best actress in the world, I have to say.
She's not the
but
best,
her supporting, like, Billy Dee Williams plays an activist and then her kind of boyfriend.
He's effortlessly charismatic.
He is. Yeah. I like him a lot. And he brings a lot to that role, because actually he's a kind of a terrible boyfriend. Like, all the men in this film are horrible, actually. But Billy Dee Williams manages to bring this, like, kind charisma to it, which kind of slightly saves it a bit.
Takes the edge off.
Oh my God. But yeah, but the designs in it, her wardrobe is kind of a bit mad. Diana Ross actually designed the costumes.
All right. When I was looking at the crowd, I was like, oh my, wow. Because I was wanting to get your take on the costume designs of the character / Diana Ross. So talk me through, what's her style?
It's sort of a kind of Asian exploitation vibes going on, right?
Like, okay.
There's definitely sort of Japanese referencing with her designs of these kimonos,
right,
that we get at the end.
Kimonos.
And that feels quite 70s, right? Like, you wouldn't, you do see designs like this today, but they don't get away with it. Like, that's pretty controversial. And I think it feels very costumey. And you compare it, you can tell when she's not wearing one of her own designs, because there is some really, I love the wardrobe in this film on the whole, overall. And actually, I even enjoy her costumes. Like, I like them in the film. It just almost adds to it.
They're fun.
Because nothing feels believable whatsoever. But to bring it back to it, I really thought this would be a good one to talk about, because this film came out at the peak of Diana Ross's It Girl kind of moment. And actually, this is the funny thing about It Girls, is that it is such a reductive, dismissive term, because it does hinge on this thing of not really having a job and just having something about them. But often these It Girls were doing incredible things. Diana Ross was a superstar, you know, she was a singer with an incredible performer, best voice ever. And clearly, okay, maybe not the best actor in the world, but she has a lot of talent, and that's kind of what happens in this film, right? She wants to be a designer, and then she ends up
being
a model.
Taken seriously for her work.
Yeah.
It is, isn't it, that that somehow a real life It Girl's credentials, which are, like you say, being a multi-hyphenate, and yet in the fictional film that she plays, she's then reduced to playing someone who seems to have ambitions, but the thing that makes her famous is just her looks.
Yeah, exactly. And constantly being hurt and punished because of it, which again, I think, is another important aspect of the It Girl. Often It Girls ended up having kind of terrible fates, and Mahogany seems to... Well, what do you think the moral message of Mahogany is?
I mean, everything's so confused and unfocused. I just wasn't... The moral message of Mahogany is... Well, you can have ambitions, but don't get too hung up on them, because I guess if you're attractive, things will happen. I don't know. It was very confusingly. Please, if you've got any insight. I was just very confused by everybody's motivation.
Like, she ends up completely failing and goes back. I feel like you blanked the whole movie out. You're so traumatized.
I have to say, that was a difficult watch for me, Lily.
Really?
So yeah, I have actually.
God, I quite love it. I have to say, I love it. It's it, Well, I feel like I've put through the ringer this episode, actually. I'll be intrigued to hear your thoughts on Factory Girl, our next one.
Oh, no, the other two films I had lots of fun with, and I can see that Mahogany's like a bit of a bad movie, good vibe. Just, I was just like too thrown by the directing all the time. Like, why is anybody acting like any of this at all? But I get it. If you just go for the, I think if I'd have gone into it knowing it was going to be more a bad movie, I'd have fully embraced it. But what is the moral of the story, Lily?
Well, I don't know. The peak of the film is when the evil photographer gets killed while taking her photo, and she's free of him. And she then is offered, she's a financial backer comes out of the woodwork to help her launch her own collection. But then he makes it clear that he'll only keep backing her financially if she has sex with him. And
God damn it, no such thing as a free lunch.
Exactly. And so she ends up going back to Chicago and getting back with Billy Dee Williams. So basically all of her dreams and ambitions fail. Because the bit I was baffled by, I'm like, you're the biggest model in the world right now, or at least a huge star in Rome. Like, you don't have to go back to bloody Chicago. Like, hey, love Chicago, but don't have to go back there just because you right now your designs aren't taking off. It was such a bum out thing of like, if you're a woman, especially an attractive one, you'll only get anywhere if men help you along the way. And then ultimately, it probably won't work out. So just go back to where you came from. Like, it's such a depressing story ultimately.
Home. That is.
But interestingly, there is that there are some bits to it, which I think underneath there is a bit of depth to it. Because as I said, Billy Dee Williams plays an activist. And his whole thing is about trying to help everyone within the black community in Chicago who are struggling financially and aren't being supported. And he keeps saying to like, you know, this is what matters. And I mean, there's a lot of nuance to these kinds of discussions, which is definitely lost in this film.
Which is just totally gone. You're quite right. That's the other thing that I thought was frustrating. It feels like a total missed opportunity. Yeah. Like, I would love to have seen what Tony Richardson would have done with this.
Yeah, or just any director. I think it's a point. Like, I don't know if Tony Richardson, coming from Yorkshire, would fully be able to capture some of that like discourse in the best way. But like, does it have to be Berry Gordy?
Well, this is the thing. Does it have to be someone who's never directed a film and also will never direct one again? So he either got burnt from it or he just didn't really think he was not really interested. But yeah, Yeah, all the nuances and the subtleties. Like you say, the fact that we do have a black activist as one of the main characters, just not really explored in any in satisfying depth at all. I mean, I have to say, watching this, I thought, God, I'm sure that Lucas saw this and was like, right, he's got to be Lando Calrissian. Because, you know, it's heavy Lando Calrissian vibes. He's this kind of guy who's trying to do good. Billy Dee Williams plays one of the most memorable characters from the original trilogy of Star Wars. He plays Lando Calrissian, the guy in charge of Cloud City.
Okay.
You know, when in The Empire Strikes Back, have we seen The Empire Strikes Back?
I mean, I did watch it as a kid a couple of times, but right, I barely remember anything about it. I'm going to watch it again.
Sorry.
God, he's so cute.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. If you liked the vibe of Billy Dee Williams and Mahogany, you're going to love him in Empire Strikes Back, because it's essentially that charisma and that style of energy. And he's portrayed in Empire Strikes Back as this guy who's trying to make the best of the situation that he's got and improve conditions. That's kind of where he's pitching it. But, you know, there's a bit of a twist to it.
All right. So Billy Dee Williams is our it guy for the... episode.
I would say he definitely is the it guy for sure. Mm-hmm. Like I really enjoyed watching his charisma. I was like, yeah, that's definitely, they must have seen that and they thought, we want that in Star Wars, please. So we'll just transpose you from the 1970s into the far future. One thing I noticed that, one little link to from this film, because I was like, okay, so the Berry Gordy's done nothing before or after. What about the other people involved? Lots of people went on to longer careers in the film industry, but one of them, the cinematographer of Mahogany, cinematographer on one of your curveball comfort movies, Lily. He went on to shoot Tea with Mussolini.
Did he really? Oh my God. Yeah. What's his name?
Oh, now you put me on the spot. I couldn't remember. not somebody who stuck out, but I was like, oh, Tea with Mussolini.
Let me give him a shout out. Okay, so David Watkin. David Watkin, cinematographer on two of the greatest films, Tea with Mussolini and Mahogany. Oh my God, that's amazing. What else has he done? How I Won the War, Gloria, Mademoiselle. I think him and Tony Richardson probably had a bit of, had a good friendship because he directed Mademoiselle,
didn't
he? Do
you think he brought him on?
I'm guessing so.
Right.
Oh, he did The Boyfriend as well. Wow. Oh, and Moonstruck.
Yeah. Oh, he did. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Wow. He's done some great stuff. All right, cool. Good on you, David Walken. So a
little link to our comfort movies episode. And, you know, if you're ready to move on to Factory Girl, I could link Factory Girl to one of our previous podcasts as well.
I would love that. I have a lot of links between Mahogany and Factory Girl I want to get into, but we'll do that in the main discussion. Give me your throwback, callback.
Okay. So call back to our podcast episode, Don't Watch the Movie, Watch the Documentary About the Movie. The director of Factory Girl, George Hickenlooper, directed Hearts of Darkness. He directed that documentary.
Oh my God, of course he did. I thought his name looked familiar. Oh, very good, very good. Well, Factory Girl, this movie came out in 2006, if you guys haven't heard of it. And it stars Sienna Miller as Edie Sedgwick. The kind of, in my mind, okay, here's what I was thinking, right? So Carolina Donahue, she is an author who also has a podcast called Sentimental Garbage that I love. And I remember in one episode, she talks about how everyone is born under an icon, like a diva star. So you have your diva that is yours, like Cher or Madonna. And I'm thinking it might be the same with It Girls, perhaps. And for us, it's Tara Palmer Tomkinson. It definitely is for you. I'm still deciding what mine is. It could well be Edie Sedgwick. But she feels like the most iconic of the It Girls. She sums up as the certain, the kind we were talking about that comes from the upper class, has a very tragic story, falls in with the coolest people, is a bit of a mystery and a question. And that is all kind of captured and explored in this film, right?
I really enjoyed this film. You know, maybe it was just because coming off the back of Mahogany, anything would have seemed exceptional.
Yeah.
It's certainly, you know, not without its faults, but actually I thought it was a solidly done movie. Did what I expect this kind of film to do. There's some bits that were a bit funny that we'll get into, but I didn't really know much about Edie Sedgwick at all, I have to say. So I was interested in watching this film just to learn about her as a character. So I didn't realize she was someone from society, so like a trust fund baby character. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really know much of the story. I'd probably heard of her just in relation to Andy Warhol, but that's literally as much as I knew. So what, as well, watching it, I was like, oh, it's almost like an echo of Breakfast at Tiffany's, of Audrey Hepburn's character in that, Holly Golightly. She's kind of what happens a decade later, let's say, roughly. I mean, I don't know.
It was around the same time. Edie Sedgwick was, in fact, she was known to have been a fan of that movie and kind of wanted to emulate Audrey Hepburn in it. Much related to that character.
Yeah, it's just like the dark version. It's of Holly Golightly. You know, there's like,
well, Holly Golightly is pretty dark, I think. But yeah, I know,
In Breakfast at Tiffany's, things are more hinted at, whereas here it's like, let's get a close up of that needle going in. God damn, I don't like seeing needles going in films. That made me wince. But
I think with both It and Mahogany, these are films which, they reflected their stars, like the actresses who were playing those roles. It wasn't necessarily that the part they're playing is really, even in It, it's really an It Girl. That's not really what's been captured in the film exactly, but it's using the It Girl charisma
their
that they already
power.
Have. Exactly. And then, so it's kind of more, if we're talking about this in this topic of conversation, it's capturing on film these qualities that make those women in the real world It Girls.
Whereas, that's a really good point, yeah.
Whereas I think Factory Girl is kind of, that film is trying to capture an It Girl in kind of that form, that kind of mystery, vulnerability, glamour.
Factory Girl is less about trading on Sienna Miller's It Girl status. It's about an It Girl.
No.
And I have to say
I disagree completely.
Disagree. Strong disagree.
But go on. But what were you going to say before I cut you off with that hard no?
No, because I know she's seen as an it girl, but I thought it was a film that was very well acted by Sienna Miller compared to the, you know, it's hard to judge the acting of it. Certainly we could judge the acting a bit more honestly and Mahogany, but I just thought out of the three films, the central performance by Sienna Miller, I thought it was really engaging, really nuanced. I thought she inhabited the character. So, you know, out of the three films, I think it's the best performance of the three.
Oh, James, I love you. I love you for saying that. That is so nice to hear because this is a film that I watched many times as a teenager.
This was one of your...
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, like one of those films, I think, for teenage girls who it's like, oh, she's so glamorous, she's so cool. But a big part of that was the fact that at this time, 2006... this was the peak of It Girls, the kind of final iteration of It Girls. Like, we can go on to talk about that, where we're at now with this concept. But Sienna Miller was definitely part of the London scene of It Girls. And she, it seems to me, I mean, Sienna Miller is a very good actor, a really, really good actor. And she was very much at that time, the press and culture kind of positioned her as Jude Law's girlfriend and someone who dresses well, was basically like isolated as an it girl rather than being recognized as an actress. She wasn't taken seriously, partly because the only roles at that point early in her career that she was given were basically, as she called it, I remember clearly in an article, tits and ass roles, where she was just being shot in her underwear, like layer cake, that kind of thing. So this film was like the first film where she was actually getting a meaty role.
Yeah.
But the film was completely panned. Like, it's got 20% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's considered not a good movie. And I read various reviews from the time and they kind of just say she's okay, she's passable. When I thought she brings so much to this role, there is a lot that's wrong with this film. And actually the way I think the film films her, it's the camera is in love with her and definitely thinks of Edie and Sienna as Edie is like an it girl, and there is a lot of, I think, objectifying in the way that she is filmed, but she herself brings so much heart and nuance to that role that I think it's so unfair how she, and it, so it just feels like that film is treated as if it's very much trading on her star power, her it girl power. There isn't a lot, I don't think culturally it's considered, it's basically.
Maybe that's one of the advantages for me of really just coming to this film for the first time now. I've never seen it before. And I have to say, how you described Sienna Miller, how she was kind of covered by the press, how I ever knew who Sienna Miller was is that she was reported as Jude Law's girlfriend, that she was an it girl. And so I think in my mind, I had her tagged, lazily tagged as like, probably not very good. She's just coasting on like the it girlness. So as you were saying earlier about how being tagged as an it girl could be detrimental to your career. I mean, that was my first impression, let's say, or how my impressions were molded of Sienna Miller. And then I have to say the past 10 years, when I've seen a film with Sienna Miller in, I've always been impressed by her performance. That's kind of had to erode away the impression I first had, because first impressions do bloody last. I do think that watching this Factory Girl, just seeing it as a film, really, and I really thought that's a really good performance by Sienna Miller. I think she really carries the film. I think that's one of the high points of the film is her performance.
Absolutely. And so there's this interesting dialogue going on then between Edie Sedgwick, the it girl being shown on film, and then the woman playing her, who is a contemporary, you know, 40 years later, contemporary it girl, which I do think is part of what she brings to it. Of course, their worlds are very different, but I do think there is something comparable in both how they're treated in the press and in the public eye.
So maybe this is the ultimate, as far as it's channeling, it's the ultimate use of an actor's it girl credentials into a film about an it girl. One thing we can say about Clara Bow's performance is, yes, it's very charismatic, but it's probably not very nuanced and detailed, where that's definitely the case in Factory Girl.
I think so.
So you know, for an actor, I mean, what a great character of Edie Sedgwick. There's so much range she has. You know, we go from highs to lows. We see a breakdown and a recovery. And also, I have to say, Guy Pearce, I wouldn't say it's an incredible role, but he doesn't fuck it up. He doesn't get in the way. You know, he's a solid... I thought he was a solid Andy Warhol, you know.
I thought he was great.
I bought into it.
I love Guy Pearce. Yeah. He can do no wrong for me.
Any film with Guy Pearce, and he never fucks it up. I thought him and Sienna Miller really held the screen together well. Where it fell apart, I was like, oh my God, this was definitely some stunt casting. It's like, right, let's get a name in who's going to bring people in. Let's get the guy who's currently playing Darth Vader in the Star Wars prequels. Let's get Hayden Christensen in.
Yes, he plays Bob Dylan doppelganger. Billy Quinn.
It's clearly Bob Dylan he's playing. And without even Googling, I was like, clearly for legal reasons, at some point they've gone, oh, we can't call them Bob Dylan. He'll sue us because he's still alive.
Well, no, he did threaten to sue them. Apparently they did. Originally he was called Bob Dylan. And in the original script, he has more of a hand in her mistreatment. And so that's kind of the implication that he was also partly responsible for her death. And yeah, Bob Dylan's people threatened. So they took out any mention of his name and then named him Billy Quinn in kind of the press around the film.
Oh my God. Unfortunately, Hayden Christensen, like he doesn't quite fit in. And,
he's a little bit wooden.
Sienna Miller acts him off the screen. When they share scenes together, which is most of their scenes, to be honest, she's clearly got the range, the nuance, and it's a shame, you know, it's a shame because he's the one bit of casting that just doesn't quite pull off.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Yeah, you can see this real chemistry between Guy Pearce and Sienna Miller in it. I honestly think it speaks to how good an actor she is that she still shines even when she's having to act against this, like, stilted guy.
Wooden. Yeah. You know, he was a man of the moment.
I know. Yeah. What's he up to these days? What's he doing? Hayden, what are you up to?
Well, he's back in playing Anakin Skywalker in the Obi-Wan Kenobi TV series.
Okay. Fair. At least he's working.
Gotta pay them bills.
I'm happy for him. All right. Well, I kind of wanted to wrap up by just contemplating with you the it girl of today. Where are we at with the term it girl? James, I know you've given this much thought over the years.
Many thoughts of these, and also thankfully reading that wonderful New Yorker article about the it girl, is that the it girl's kind of changed that because part of the appeal of the it girl was the kind of mystery element. And nowadays, to be anybody really, you have to be on social media, and social media removes that mystery layer. And to survive these days, I think you need to have like an agent and a manager and all these things. So you're almost like a professional it girl these days, which then by definition, you're not an it girl.
Totally, totally. It basically is kind of a redundant term anymore. One of the interviews I read with all these various it girls that were listed in the New York Magazine article said that it's a 20th century term. It's a bit dated. It's not right now. And I think that's right. And I was thinking, honey, to bring it back to our favorite topic, it's kind of like cinema itself, right? And that film. Okay. So there is a big separation between film stars and it girls. I definitely think the film world, as we've said, like looked down its nose at it girls, but they are very much tied together because film so dictated what was hot and like taste and what was considered the cool, beautiful, interesting people of the moment, what we deemed attractive. Because the thing about it girls is they're very much tied to the culture of the time. Like Clara Bow wouldn't be an it girl today, but she was very much
was
peak at that point. You know, they're so reflective of the time we're in. And now cinema doesn't do that anymore, right? Like cinema doesn't have the power over cultural tastes anymore.
Conversation.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you. I think that essentially it feels like movie stars and it girls, or at least as we knew them, are a dying breed. I mean, I've been reading a few articles at the moment because it's something I've been thinking about, is like, who are the next wave of big movie stars? I mean, Timothy Chalamet certainly is one, but you know, would Timothée Chalamet open a movie? Like, for example, what was it called? He did a Bones and All film that flopped. The definition of a movie star is, above and beyond everything else, is their name can get bums on seats. Mm-hmm. So Timothée Chalamet is a movie star in that he's charismatic and lots of people like him, but he's not opening, you know, his name alone doesn't guarantee you box office success. And that's what a movie star used to be. And that is a problem that Hollywood has now, is the era of somebody's name will guarantee your movie getting bums on seats, that's kind of gone.
Yeah.
And the It Girl also seemed to have gone as this, like a reflector of where culture is at the moment and somebody that is an aspirational, an influence essentially. Like,
I mean, I think it's actually, whereas it's, you're looking concerned, you're looking sad, James. It's worrying for cinema.
I'm pondering. Now you brought cinema into it. I'm like, oh my God, you're so right. I think girls and cinema, they're both dying.
I think so. But actually the difference is it's a good thing that girls are dying. I mean, not literally dying, but...
sure.
Because now, you said, like, because of social media, the It Girl has complete control over her brand and is therefore able to make money out of it, which by definition stops her being an It Girl, but it also gives her complete control and power. And it's a very problematic concept, the It Girl. It's not good for the women who are called it, even though it seems like a nice thing. Like we all want to be It Girls, but actually there is nothing to it. It's kind of a fake, false thing. So I think it's good for It Girls, just not good for cinema. Sorry, babe.
Oh no. God damn it. Swings and roundabouts.
Swings and roundabouts. But you know what? Do we need movies? Like, oh, I don't know. We'll have to talk about this more in another episode. But just because things are different and change doesn't necessarily mean the change is bad. We just have to find a new way of getting those bums on seats. And right now, obviously, that's not really happening, or at least not in the way you and I would prefer.
We're in a period of turbulent transition that the industry's never seen, and it's not clear how we're going to come out of it. I hope it means we'll see less films, but they've got more care and attention given to them. I think the days of just being able to put out almost anything and just the fact that somebody's name is attached to it will get people in. I think those days are long gone.
Yeah. Definitely.
But can I just ask, well, when you were watching Factory Girl back in the day, back in the noughties, were you enticed by the It Girl phenomena? Did you see them as cool and aspirational?
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. I was like looking at the blogs, seeing what Daisy Lowe wearing, getting Doc Martens like Chloe Sevigny was wearing. Yeah, I was completely enticed by them at that age, for sure. I'm not ashamed to say it. They're alluring, but there isn't... It's not a great aspect of celebrity for women, that's for sure. But yeah, I was completely hooked. The mystery of them, the style... I was sucked in. I loved Sienna Miller's style then. I loved her boho bags.
Great, okay.
All right, well, shall we finish up with our final film pharmacy of the series?
Oh, yes, please.
All right, so here we go. I'm planning a trip to New York on my own during autumn. However, I haven't traveled by myself in a long time, and sometimes I'm afraid I'll feel too lonely. Do you have any tips to A, inspire my travel plans, and B, remind me of the joys of traveling by myself? Juicy.
That's a good one.
I love this one. This is a great one. Though I did struggle slightly to think of an answer, but...
I would love to hear it, please.
All right. It is a film called Eat, Pray, Love. No, I'm just kidding. Just joking. No. So I was thinking...
We don't do jokes on this podcast. No humor, no joking. Lily, this is a serious
James
film podcast.
Face like froze.
How many times?
I couldn't even keep it going. Okay, so I'm thinking the Before trilogy, specifically Before Sunrise, I think is a great film to watch if you're planning to go on a solo trip. Not because you'll necessarily fall in love with someone on your trip, but the thing for me that is like, the best and most almost exhilarating thing about solo travel is getting to talk to people that you wouldn't have otherwise encountered and having a really good conversation with a stranger and connecting with them. Like, I actually lived in New York for 6 months when I was 21, and I have these few moments where I talk to a stranger there. Like, I was going into work one day and I just ran into this guy who was waiting at the same place to try and give some flowers to his girlfriend he had a fight with the night before, and the door wasn't locked, so we both sat there on the stoop and he was telling me about his argument, and we got talking about portmanteaus. It was the most random meandering conversation, and of course I never saw this guy again after he'd delivered the apology flowers, but it just stays in your mind, these like amazing conversations. And that film just perfectly shows that, because it's Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy bumping into each other on a train somewhere in Europe.
It's that magic of the possibility of what could happen if you solo travel. And so you meet someone, you have this incredible connection. That film is the definitive version of the potential for what might happen if you are by yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think watch that and feel excited by the, like you say, the potential, the possibilities, because that is the best bit. All the other bits, the beautiful scenery, the like, you know, all of that stuff you can do alone or you can do with other people, you'll have a good time. But that is the thing that really is you won't have that same thing if you're with other people. So it is definitely the like most special bit of solo travel.
Absolutely. And I love that suggestion. It was one that I was pondering. So I'm glad that I managed to dig another one out of the cinematic vault there, otherwise we'd have been in trouble. But so that's the potential. I feel like I wanted to offer something a bit more New York centric in my offer. So I was thinking what could it be? The kind of how to have fun by yourself, or the unexpectedness of New York, like how to do New York. And I just thought, you know what, maybe it's Martin Scorsese's After Hours. So a film about somebody who after midnight, I think, ends up on a succession of surrealistic adventures and encounters around like nighttime New York. It's a bit crazy and it's a bit mad, but that's what New York's like. And so I think it's a good little primer for the mindset, maybe, to have adventures in New York by yourself.
Yes, that's such a good suggestion. Okay, please do watch both movies. Let us know what you think. And if anyone would to send a submission to the Film Pharmacy, we'll be bringing it back next series. So we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at groovymoviespod@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.
And please leave us a like or a 5-star review, because it all helps us get discovered by a new audience.
Yes, please do. All right. Well, we will see you in about 6 weeks for Barbie and Oppenheimer. Look forward to that.
Oh, can't wait.
And thank you.
I'm
so
choosing
much
the
for
cinemas.
Listening.
I get to choose the cinemas at last.
Oh my god! Yeah, it's gonna, I think it's,
I can force IMAX? You. I'm forcing you to.
Are we
going to see Oppenheimer in IMAX?
Okay.
A film IMAX, and then we're going to see the Barbie Dolby Digital Dolby Theatre. So.
Oh my god! It's going to be an intense day, but I'm excited. I cannot wait. All right.
Can't wait.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Follow us on Instagram @groovymoviespod or email us groovymoviespod@gmail.com.
Groovy Movies was produced and edited by Lily Austin.
Music and sound by James Brailsford.
Our logo was designed by Abby Jo Sheldon.
For references and more information about the films discussed, check out the show notes.